The end of the year is always a time to reflect, and here at the Startup Leap, it's been an absolutely incredible year. Actually, 5 months. Over 150,000 views across all our channels on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
To every single one of our listeners, yes, you, we are so glad to have graced your screens, your headphones, and spent time with you the last few months. Seriously, thank you. Whether you've spent a few minutes with us or countless hours with us and our amazing guests, you've made this journey so rewarding. We couldn't have done it without you.
So as we round up the year and celebrate Christmas holidays and into the new year, we thought it'd be the perfect time to share some of our favorite moments and reflections from guest conversations this season.
So go ahead, settle in. Whether you're doing some last minute Christmas shopping, wrapping or unwrapping gifts, let us be your companion for the next hour. So let's dive in.
Welcome to The Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on The Startup Leap, we hear real, raw, and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap, and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is The Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Hey, before we dive into the episode real quick, we've got a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the podcast, hit that subscribe button.
Yep, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else, subscribing and following us is the easiest way that you can make sure you never miss an episode.
And while you're at it, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to join the Startup Leap community. We've got a lot planned for you. So head on to subscribe.thestartupleap.io to get exclusive tips, resources, and updates straight into your inbox.
It's free, it's quick, and it's packed with value for you. So subscribe, follow The Startup Leap wherever you are watching or listening, and let's keep the conversation going.
Done? Okay, now let's get back to the episode.
Maria, what a crazy year it's been.
2024 has been insane.
One for the books.
One for the books. You know, I'm thinking back to like January this year, and I'm like, what was my frame of mind in January? I feel like it's just been a blur. So much has happened.
I mean, I can't believe we're in December.
I know. I feel like people say this every year, but I feel like it's true.
Yeah.
I can't believe we're in December. It's been insane. What's been the year like for you?
It's been a year of reflecting. Mm. So started the year with a bit of time off. Obviously, I was had my daughter and now she's just turned one. So it's been a year of just like getting back into the groove of things and being very intentional with how I use my time.
Yeah.
So saying no more to the opportunities that come
year
my way.
Of no.
Exactly, which I think is really, really important. Yeah. Just optimizing for the time that we have, right? And then just doubling down, leaning into the things that I do want to spend more of my time on.
Yeah, I love it. You know, it's so easy to be in the grind. It's hard to be deliberate sometimes. Mm. So I love when people like take time and be like, you know what? I'm going to be intentional. Yeah. I'm in the driver's seat of this thing. So I really like that. For me, it's been a blur, and it literally has been because obviously, the fund started this year.
Yeah.
Actually,
in
we
May,
launched in May, end of May, early June. I think it's end of May. So the year was obviously up, a lead up until that. And then after that, so I just feel like it's been chaos. And then we decided to do a podcast to add to that. So, but
which was in, it's I been, think it was like end of July, like 30th of July.
That was when we launched. Right? It's been barely like 6 months. It's
and
insane.
And over 20 episodes in, here we are.
I know. I can't even imagine we've done 20 episodes.
It's crazy.
But it's great. I enjoy the conversation.
I love the conversation.
And which would you say are like your faves? You don't have to pick your babies, but like any any ones that kind of come to mind, okay, you think about a bit more.
So one that immediately comes to mind is Sate's episode.
Yeah.
Now the reason why I love that is, first of all, I just think it's a lesson in hustle.
Mm.
The fact that he was, you know, going out, sending these CEOs cold messages.
Send
at such
us
a
cold
young
messages.
Age,
yeah.
Such a young age. And the fruits of it. He actually landed his first role from that. And then thinking about him, fast forward to him sharing how like that founder market fit within the logistics space, because obviously he had done something in the mental health space and he had done something in the fintech space.
Yeah.
But he realized that actually come back to his roots where he had a unique insight was best place for him to build something of value. And I think that's so important, right?
Yeah.
Let's build something where you believe you have a unique insight to really build something that, you know, others can't do.
Yeah, and can't easily compete with, to be honest. I think experienced operators think of building differently. Yeah. They're kind of a bit more deliberate. It's kind of like, I just remember Tim's episode where he was like, you know, passion is overrated. Yeah. I led with my pocket. I think passion is important, but I also think that we over-index 100%. On it. Relevant experiences, it helps because, like, and I think that experienced operators are being more strategic. Yeah. They're just like, I want to build in this space. Yes, I'm passionate about this problem, but do I really have a right to the market? Can
and
I?
And coming back to Sate's episode where he shared that he was passionate about like mental health, but really he realized beyond the passion, is this where I see myself working?
There was something he said, I think I remember, he was like, it was just too hard or something like that. Where it was like, it was the amount of expertise, the upskilling, it was just too much trying to compete with others who probably have an edge. I really like that episode, actually. And
how
also,
about you? What's one of your faves?
You know, I would even like, mine, I have too many. Okay. I have like moments, but on one that kind of comes to mind very quickly is one with Richard Robinson of Robin AI. And that one, it just had so many gems. I really liked about his approach to entrepreneurship was that, one, he was counterintuitive, but very thoughtful about how he approached the market. One thing that comes to mind from what he said, and there were many things he said, was how during COVID, everyone was like, default alive, like, stay lean, like, don't spend. And he was like, exactly.
He
was like,
paid off.
And it paid off. He was like, look, you're going to have talent sitting at home, like high quality talent that we probably wouldn't have gotten. Anyways, I really like that kind of astute, like precise thinking.
And I think that's a lesson in, like, sometimes as a CEO, you have to go against what everyone else is telling you, right? And you will know that that's the right thing to do because you have the context of the market, your customers, and you have to have the confidence to make that decision.
Yeah, yeah. You have to be contrarian and right. You have to think about it and be like, what would I do? And even if it's against the mold, so long as you have a solid logic and you know, you have conviction, you should totally do it. I really, really like that.
And just to that point, I feel like it's not about being contrarian. It's about being truth-seeking. Right.
And if you happen to be contrarian,
then
that's right. Yeah.
Being comfortable with that.
Yeah. I really like that. Another thing about Richard's episode that I quite like was also just how he had built something before, but had this like fear of failure and didn't want to like stake his reputation, you know, like he kind of went through that. And I love the fact that he was self-aware and honest about it, because I think most entrepreneurs go through this, right? Oh, do I tell people I'm doing this? Oh my God, I'm going to look silly. Oh my God, it's so, like, people are going to, like, you know, talk about me. Nobody cares.
And just to that point, one thing I really loved about his episode was the fact that he said he didn't really look at the competition.
Oh yeah, I remember that line. He's like, I don't pay attention to competition.
And that's so interesting, right? Because you go into these conversations and sometimes, like, when you're speaking to investors, like, tell me about the competitive landscape. Yeah, and he was like, if we have competition, our customers will tell us.
I really like that, because it's also a way to, I mean, people have different views on this. There are people that really think you need to map out the competition. And I don't think it's right or wrong.
Yeah.
I think you just need to find what works for you. And that was what worked for him. And honestly, to be honest, the litmus test of having your customers tell you about your competition is probably a very good filter.
Honestly.
Because, like, not all competition
comes back to
needs
speaking to
be
your customers, right?
Exactly.
And that's where most of your time and energy should be in the early days.
Exactly. I love that. Any other funny or insightful, like, bits in the episodes that come to mind?
Samir's episode.
Yeah.
So Samir, that episode was definitely one of my, up there in terms of one of my favorites. And for me, when he spoke about the dating app that he previously built and the fact that he had hit after hit after hit after hit.
Yeah.
But it came back to the mission and the why of why he was trying to solve the problem, and having such belief in that he was well positioned to solve it. And again, I just think it highlights that being mission driven as a founder, like, what is the why? What's really driving you? Because we know that the journey is not smooth, right? And so if you could really dig deep and understand, like, why you're doing this, it makes those hits even more worthwhile.
Yeah, I really liked that episode as well. Mostly because it actually felt like a conversation. Like, it was a long episode, but I enjoyed it. To your point, I completely agree. It's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. what keeps you going. Two things that I really liked about that episode. One was where he did counterintuitive market insights. He was like, he went to meet his sisters. Yeah. He was like, okay, so what would you, you know, he went to meet his friends. He was like, what would you do on a dating app normally? And then they told him and he was like, okay, let's go do the exact opposite, because they were not the type of people that he was like kind of optimized for, yeah, for like a traditional like African or like Egyptian dating app. I thought that was interesting, because sometimes, you know how they say like obsess over the customer? Sometimes you almost need to design in a very clever way. Mm. Sometimes you need to think beyond what the customer, you know, wants or what they think they want, yeah, and build what they want, but they don't even realize they want yet. So I thought that was interesting. The other one that I thought was very insightful, also just keeps me thinking, is like, just dreams have a timeline.
Yeah.
Things that you want to achieve, there's windows for them. And yes, you know, you can do anything at any time in your life, but we can't lie that certain times are much more, exactly, you know, optimized for trying to do things than other. And I think this was in relation to him being a footballer, yeah, at the time, and him really wanting to play football, but then he had an injury, and then he realized, you know what, there's often a window. If you don't take advantage of it, that window can close.
Yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. Another episode that really resonated with me was Shay's episode.
Ooh.
I mean, he had took himself from the US to Taiwan,
yeah,
to really develop his craft.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you do have to take yourself out of your comfort zone. And that's something that really resonated with me, because I have been on a similar journey, yeah, where I've lived in different countries.
Yeah.
And sometimes it does take doing, yeah, that in order for you to reach your full potential.
Correct. I completely agree. I mean, I'm an immigrant. Like, I came from Nigeria, yeah, to the UK 5 years ago. And I definitely see a thread with our guests, on at least some of them, where they tend to move from place to place. So I remember Ed's episode.
Yeah.
He was based out of Australia. And he was like, you know what? I really want to, you know, move and kind of grow. Came to the US and, yeah, then to London. I keep seeing that, you know, transition, mm-hmm, of people moving. Another thing I loved about Shay's episode to that point, because I think Shay's personality really comes as someone very thoughtful and 100%. Very deliberate and actually quite resilient, because he'd been building Gravity Sketch for 10 yeah. years. Like, that is not a joke. And that actually was an interesting one, because it spun out of their grad program, yeah, with him and his co-founder at
and
the
even
time.
Then he went and got a job
and was then, working and whilst work building
it. Yeah, yeah. I think that's very interesting, because oftentimes it's like raise and
take the leap, yeah, and it's exactly. like it's like just like jump. It's like sometimes no, the leap is actually yeah. careful and gradual.
Come back to that point around yeah. timing, right? And
yeah.
another thing that I loved about his episode was just around the fact that he was very intentional with the team.
Yeah,
and he flew them out to his hometown to spend time with them.
Yeah,
away from like us. Them trying to build, right?
Yeah.
And just really getting to know them.
Yeah.
And ensuring that he had made the right decision, that these are the people that I want to build with for the next 10 years.
Yeah. And also, fun fact, he found his co-founder, his tech co-founder on Upwork. Yeah. I was like, that is, what are the odds of
exactly.
that, like, you finding a co-founder? Probably, it obviously didn't happen that he just went on Upwork yeah. and found him, but they kind of worked together and somehow it worked out. I really liked that episode. And finally on, I think, Shay, one thought that keeps coming to my mind is his statement on the first investor being yourself.
Yeah, that was
because it's
powerful.
The truth. Yeah, yeah, it's actually the truth. You want investors to invest in your startup. You want people to be bought in, but people are looking to you. How bought in are you?
Yeah.
What risk are you taking? How important is this to you?
Yeah.
And he said something as well, something along the lines of that, even if it doesn't work out, the way he saw it was an investment anyway, because he would have
It'll
gained
pay off.
Lessons.
Exactly.
And I was like, that is such a fresh way to think about
way
things.
To think about
yeah,
it.
I'm just like, oh my God, I wouldn't have thought that.
It almost reframes the way we think about failure
yeah.
right, as well, that even if it doesn't work out, there's so many learnings that you take from
yeah.
any journey. So
yeah, completely
that.
Agree. The other episode that I think really highlighted and kind of moved away from just like the hustle narrative was Julia's episode. Because she was like, look, you're never going to be as joyful, you're never going to be as centered as your business,
yeah.
especially at the earliest stages as you are. I mean, especially at the earliest stages, you as a founder are the person who's holding the business together. If you're not okay, the business is not
yeah.
okay. So
yeah.
I really like the fact that she was deliberate. She came across as
exactly.
very deliberate about wellness, but also the team, because she's an incredibly
yeah.
experienced founder
and I think
an
it
operator
comes from
too.
That place of experience,
yeah.
right? Where, you know, she's got to a place where she realized how important that is.
And Julia, and Julia's experience also, I think, was interesting, because she had built as an operator. She had
yeah.
been a co-founder of a startup, and then she built her own startup
yeah.
that was in the FMCG, like the food business
she's
space.
Done it all.
Then she moved into tech. as a solo founder, I'm just like, she's like touched on every single like founding experience. Another so for her to come with that,
I loved on her episode was just around the team and how really optimizing for hiring slowly but and firing fast. Yeah. And we hear that all the time, but just hearing her experience and how sometimes
don't rush
you can rush because you feel under pressure. For example, you need to ship out product or you need to, you know, achieve those sales goals, but really like that can
it can cost you,
it can have a negative impact. And being really intentional about that hiring process as well.
I really I thought the episode was super interesting as well. Any other episodes?
I mean, one episode that I really loved was Sabrina's, just because it was such a different perspective.
It was so different.
She hadn't raised any venture capital funding. She was like a very mature, experienced operator.
I think she was 50 at the time she started her fintech startup. And she didn't fit the mold in what people consider, which is a little infuriating sometimes, because I feel like, you know, there's often this conversation around diversity, but it looks like many different ways. It's just like we don't coalesce to a certain type of profile. And she like broke everything. Exactly. She was like a more mature founder, but had like deep operating experience at like Coutts, at Barclays, at these large banks, and then decided to start her own fintech. And she didn't receive a dime in VC funding. Yeah. That was, I felt
similar to Sait's story, right?
True, I mean, actually.
He had set out to raise VC funding and realized, actually, you know, this is not the path I want to take for Hutch. Yeah. However, with Pimento, it's something that he's thinking about. So also just knowing the path that you want to take
and
being really intentional about it.
Yeah, it's been actually lots of exciting episodes. So I would encourage all our listeners and watchers to actually go check all of this. If you're watching or listening, they're incredible episodes. I don't think we're going to be able to touch on every single one of them, but each and every one of them has something that will give you some perspective or make you think a little bit differently, or at the very minimum, you actually, you know, are entertained and you learn something new or you have a laugh. So do check out the episodes. We laugh a lot. We laugh a lot in our episodes. It's because most of our guests are actually super, like many, I would say all of them are cool people.
Definitely.
Didn't finish college and I just remember having to sort of figure out what am I going to do. And I developed this really good skill of emailing CEOs to find work, right? So I never had a CV and I would always just send an email to say, hey, this is who I am. This is what I can do. I'm willing to work for free. Just cover my travel and I'll come in and I can help do whatever. And I remember coming across this website of the 50 most interesting startups in London type list. And I emailed every single one.
I love that. You're just shooting your shot.
Yeah, just shooting my shot.
It's sales. It's actually pitching.
It was the first time I had to really pitch myself. And one of the first responses was from the CEO of Henchman at the time. And he was basically like, what are you doing tomorrow? I was like, I'm around, I can come in. So I made a trek to the offices in Tottenham Court Road. Had no idea that at that moment, it was such a shoot your shot moment that I didn't actually know what all of the startups did. I just reached out to every single one, right? My theory was it would be easier to do it with startups than it would be a regular sort of, I guess, a corporate company. Mm-hmm. I think founder market fit is a very real thing, right? It wasn't my problem. It wasn't my story, right? It was my friend's story. And though I was very inspired by it and very moved by it, it wasn't my day-to-day experience. I hadn't even seen a therapist myself, right? And I think those, I guess, gaps start to show as you're moving through the journey. And it's like, the gulf and the knowledge gap to close, you realize is massive, right? It's so
despite
big.
Despite the passion.
So I think I started to find that it was harder than it should have been. You have to overcome the language barrier, right? It's a whole different sector. You have to overcome the lack of network barrier. You have to overcome your lack of profile and your lack of credibility barrier. And there's so much to overcome.
And one of the things that you've said is you don't believe that you actually have to have a passion before you start a business, right?
We're going there.
And so when you started FanBytes, did you lead with your heart or did you lead with your head? Tell us, how important was the passion behind...
I led with none of them. I led with my pocket.
Okay, so tell
I
us
basically
more.
Saw a market opportunity in the influencer world and I thought, all right, cool, we're going to capitalize on it. So I think that the idea of being passionate is massively overrated at the beginning. I became quite passionate about it, I'll say, in year three. If I was to think about the waves of passion I had for Fanbyte, it probably went no real passion, market opportunity, and then a bit of passion. And then basically like year five, I was like less passion because the company got bigger and I got less passionate about the things I was doing. Mm.
And so you wasn't driven by passion. So it was the opportunity rather that drove you.
Yeah, I think the opportunity, the money that was possible. And then I think halfway through, it was more like the competition.
Right.
So I started off by thinking, oh, this is a good way we could build a business that we could sell. Mm. And then halfway through, I thought, oh, actually, we could win this market. Mm. And I got driven by competing against other people in the agency space.
Now, speaking about your early customers, you mentioned that during COVID you had three customers. Are they the three that you initially reached out to?
No. The three I reached out to at the beginning never became customers. Took too long for us to build version one. And in the end, they were not the right customers. But we refined that over time. And so, yeah, the first three customers, actually one of my very first customers was my old law firm, which I never imagined would happen. But I mostly just used my network from my time working in law. That was really where I gathered most of the people I interviewed, the customers I talked to. But those three are still customers today, 5 years later.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And I guess back then, the perception was that selling into law firms is incredibly challenging. And yes. I think that, you know, lawyers have been burnt before. The work that you do is incredibly, it requires a lot of rigor, right?
Yeah.
So just curious, when you're doing those initial sales, what do you think it was that got it over the line?
Yeah, I think everything people say about lawyers is probably true. Selling to law firms is insanely difficult. And so today we mostly work with companies. Almost all of our customers are businesses who have
in-house
legal teams.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's precisely because, like you said, it is difficult to sell to lawyers. But back then, I think people were interested in AI. They were curious. That they didn't have confidence in it the way they do today, but they were curious about what it could do. And I think that's really what we were selling, is we were trying to show people, look, we think we understand ways you can use this technology today that are useful. I'm going to save you some time. They're not that exciting. They are not the sexiest use cases or the things you see today, but they're concrete, they're dependable, and we're going to make them work. And I think that was enough to pique people's interest.
The first one that failed,
yeah.
You mentioned that you were licking your wounds.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk a bit about that.
Sure.
And the path of failure to success.
Yes.
There's also a cultural element. There are certain cultures, I would say maybe in the US, where failure is celebrated.
Yes, yes.
There are other cultures where failure is more an indictment. Yes. So I would love to talk about how you navigated that, I guess, at the time and also in retrospect when you look back now.
Yeah, I think you're right. It felt very embarrassing. And to be honest, even when we launched it, we didn't tell most of our friends. When I did it, I didn't tell most people what I was doing because I wasn't sure it would work. I was not confident I would succeed, which is completely the wrong mindset and helps it fail, actually. So we lost money, we lost time. I certainly felt embarrassed by the whole project, and it took me a while to get myself out of that mindset, because in the end, I think people do, your reputation is attached to any business that you start.
Your ego, it's a sense of, you pour your heart and soul into it.
Yeah, yeah. And most of us, you know, we've gone through education, we've gone to new companies. And so you know that people will judge you on your track record. And I worked very hard to preserve my track record. But I think as well, I've always felt like I've been throwing myself into environments where I'm learning and I'm the least knowledgeable at the beginning, and I really have to get myself to a place where I'm at the top. And I think that teaches you that to learn quickly, you have to be prepared to fail. So I tried to just shift my mindset, and I listened to a lot of podcasts, I read a lot of books, and this theme started to come out, this idea that failure is actually an important step towards progress. You're not really going to get there unless you do. Yeah. I'd never taken that approach to my career. I think I'd shown that in education, in my personal life, but never really in my career. And so that shift, it took time, and it was almost difficult to see at the time. But as I started to absorb more material, I think that was really changing my mindset. And in retrospect, most of it came from the US. You're completely right. You listen to these entrepreneurs and even the most successful ones, and they all have
a string of failures.
They're very proud of it because they can see the lessons they learned. And I learned some really important lessons from the nightclub app, actually. I wouldn't have been successful with Robin if I hadn't had that first failure to teach me things. So in retrospect, I'm really glad I did it, and I'm definitely not ashamed of it. I think it was an important step. But at the time, it was a completely different approach. And like you say, I think in the UK, being an entrepreneur is much more rare, and most people think you're crazy, which is fine. But as a result, I think it was just quite embarrassing at the time. I didn't speak about it very much. Also, one thing I never did that I definitely think is a me thing, I don't think it's unique to me, but a lot of people take a different approach. I never, ever thought about competition. Not once. I never did a competitor analysis.
Really?
I never said, okay, who else is doing this? I never went on Google and tried to find other people. It always just seemed pointless to me, to be honest. Even now, I really don't think about competition unless a customer is telling me about competition. So my focus was, let me talk to the people I want to sell to. And if there's competition out there, they'll tell me. And if they don't, then there isn't, or they don't
Interesting.
Matter. That really was my attitude. And some of it was like a defense mechanism. I didn't want,
I don't want anyone guessing in my head.
Like, look, I don't want you to psych me out and say, oh, there's this amazing competitor with all this money. You're never going to beat them. Because I actually don't, I'm not sure that's true. And I think ideas are really precious early on. I've read this about Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive. They had this great relationship because they would incubate ideas very carefully. And I really, really agree with that. I think when you're beginning to think about a new business, you have to be really careful who you share that information
with. I completely agree.
The wrong people will just, they'll crush your dream, basically. And they might be wrong. And so I think you have to be really careful. So I really did not think about competition. And maybe if I had, I wouldn't have started. So I'm glad I didn't. But it was never part of my thought process, I have to say. I tried to just talk to customers or future customers and hear what they have to say. And if there's competition, it'll come through that. That was really the way I approached it. So that never crossed my mind.
This is so interesting because the journey in building a company is never smooth, right? And this happened 4 times. You had multiple hits.
Yes.
What was it that kept you going hit after hit?
That's exactly.
What was it that kept you going?
That's
even
actually,
with the rejections that you're getting from investors, because oftentimes this can be very discouraging for entrepreneurs, right? But there must have been something that drove you to keep going. I'm really keen to hear what that was.
The problem, the women in my family, like whenever I think that if I don't do this,
then it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, and then they will keep suffering. That was my key.
So you're really driven by the mission.
By the problem, by the mission. Yeah. So, and I remember at some point after the code was gone, that was actually the third or fourth trial. And then I remember for that night, that was the first time I said, okay, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Like maybe I've tried, I did my best.
Yeah.
But then that's it. I've been spending for my own money and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
But what changed me at the same night is that idea of like, who would do it if you don't do it?
It's kind of like you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I feel like some of the biggest decisions of your life, it's not that you choose it. It's that the alternative is not an option.
So I've learned that actually dreams has a timeline.
Yeah. I love that.
And then, they expire.
Yeah.
And you need to act on them.
I love that.
It created this sense of urgency in you.
Exactly, exactly. It's like, oh, you cannot just dream about things. Like if you want something, get it.
It is, I really resonate with that because I think that many times people almost act as though life is guaranteed.
Yes.
I mean, that was an accident, but like so many things in life can happen where in that moment you just can't chase it anymore.
Exactly.
So you have to like, if you want it, act as though you're on borrowed time.
Yes.
I really like that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You learn that the window for opportunity is not forever.
Yeah.
And then if you have a great idea, or it doesn't have to be actually a business, right? Like if there's something you always want to do, you should go and have a shot at it.
Yeah.
And it's always that the regret of not doing it exactly. outweigh if you fail in it or whatever.
Exactly. Like something my father used to always say to me is, what's the worst that could happen? Yeah, just go back to normal life.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then when was it? Because I feel as if like quite a lot of people are quite hesitant to bring someone in as a co-founder, right? So when did you have that aha moment that he was the one?
Or was it just logical? It was just like so natural. It was like, hey, let's just...
I think I started to see like more and more we worked together, the more and more he would bring up ideas or things that like I hadn't even thought about. Okay. Right. It was like, okay, this guy's actually thinking beyond just like, you know, here's an executable, here's the brief. But also we started to run out of money. Right. So I'm like, at a certain point, like, I'm not going to be able to pay you to do this. Are you enjoying this? Yeah. And so, at the time, actually, the three of us went to my hometown. We went to Portland. I was just like, let's get out of London. Let's go and like, you know, like that. I feel like if you take people outside of the working environment,
you get to meet them.
You need to have a bit of reference for one another as human beings, right? And so we went and actually stayed at my family home, and you know, like we did really weird, quirky Portland things, and went on hikes and stuff like this. And then, you know, I just presented the idea to Daniel and Danielle, like, why don't we bring Daniel in as a co-founder? Yeah. And you know, he resonated with the idea, and obviously. Hashing out like what the package would be and you know, the equity and all that stuff is always a bit of a tricky thing, but ultimately he just really loved the mission that we were on.
Still with the business today.
And still with the business today. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, I feel like for every founder, the first investor is yourself.
Yeah.
And
ooh, I like that.
Yeah, it is, right? Because like now you're saying I'm going to take either a pay cut or no pay, which is what we ended up doing for over a year or so. And I'm going to say that this is going to, at some point, either give me enough in knowledge or enough in monetary return. Yeah. Like, that's what you're essentially saying. And it was very difficult for me to say, okay, like, I'm going to go all in on this.
This point to me is very interesting because Core didn't raise, at least not yet, raised a single penny in VC funding. And what I think, even in my experience with founders, I often say is that success looks many different ways. And VC is such a different asset class with its issues, as we've seen. There's a lot that can be better about that, the industry. But yet, through sheer force of will, and I would argue that your depth of experience, that edge that you mentioned earlier, that unfair advantage, even though there was the bias that was kind of really dragging that back, but the fact that you had these bosses who from the first conversation said, I will back you. This makes sense. I will put money in it. And then you had the grant to kind of get you further ahead. How far did that go? At what point did you have to go back and say, okay, I need to raise again, especially given the long sales cycles?
Yes. So obviously at the beginning, you had to raise all the time. Also because what I realized really quickly was that the kind of problem we were solving was demanding a technology that was robust and scalable and really strong. So I didn't build an app. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a workflow. We have very robust and complex technology. And it took about £10 million to build it. Wow. So I have to raise that money. And therefore, I was constantly raising capital. Mm-hmm. So the first seed was with the Innovate UK grant and some institution, some individual money, EIS, SAS. Last year, I was the EIS ESA Entrepreneur of the Year because I used so much that. I did well, but I suppose it's also because I went back. Thank God we got EIS. But then I had to raise $5 million. So that would have been probably a Series A. Mm. And I really went thinking, okay, now I can speak with the VCs because now I got big client, I got revenues. You know, for the size that we were, I had good revenues. Mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of money. Now is a good moment. And I must have had 100 interviews, maybe more. I was with PwC Raise. They were fantastic. Mm. It was a big screening. They interviewed about 600 companies and they chose 6 or 7. So I knew that we were investable. I couldn't do it. I honestly was shocked. It was about a year of doing that. In the meantime, my seed investors brought their friends.
I mean, the party has to keep going.
I have one of my investors put 1.7 million into my company of his own money. Wow. This is an absolute star, fantastic entrepreneur, really a veteran in financial services. I had another one, again, financial services veteran, who then did what I did, set up his own company and sold it for many, many millions. And he put £700,000 in my company. So I thought, oh, wait. And then they brought their friends. So there was a movement. There was a movement of wealthy, capable, experienced individuals, all for financial services, who believed that what we were doing was groundbreaking, could actually happen. And these are, you know, financial services people, they don't take a lot of risk. You know, my investor that put all that money he needed, they interviewed me for 3 days. And you want to see everything. There was lots of due diligence. So this is not a passion investing. Mm-hmm. You don't do passion investing if you, you know, are the no fox for financial services. They really knew what they were doing. And I found it much easier to raise in that way. So by the time I finished with my 100, 200 interviews with institutional investors, I raised 5 million.
But you had spent 20 years in the industry. How
28,
did you,
28.
28, not even 20, closer to 30.
I'm very old. I'm a very old woman, yes.
You look amazing. I would say, I'm curious because like you have entrepreneurs who are taking the leap at their young ages. We've had guests like as early as 14 start businesses. And now it's like you have all that experience. There was the safety net of just continuing on your career.
It's true.
Why did I do it?
It's a very good question. First of all, the thought was quite, you know, you don't get up in the morning, you say, I'm not going to be a banker anymore. I'm going to stop, you know, having a career and I'm going to start a company. It's like the company just creeps on you. The idea just happens. And then you speak with somebody else. And then some people in your team says, you know, if you do that, I'll come with you. Mm-hmm. And you speak with some people that's really experienced and they go, yeah, I see the blind spot. So it was really a gradual process. But I also want to say, especially for maybe other people that are in my position, I actually thought I had an unfair advantage, mm-hmm. which I definitely had. Had an unfair advantage because I was at an age where I still had energy, but I also had lots of technical competencies. Yeah. I had a huge network of potential clients, not only potential investors and people that could work with me. I really knew the territory, but also I was quite experienced, I want to say, you know, it wasn't easy to go through my career. So I knew that I was ready for everything. Mm-hmm. And while I went through building the company, I sometimes think, you know, the kind of challenges I faced. How can somebody that has not been in a difficult industry for 30 years survive that kind of challenges? I really feel sometimes for example, young women, having to pitch to a VC or you know, trying to sell the product to a compliance officer. I'm thinking, it's such a difficult task. But for me, it was easier because I knew how to do it. Because
you had already
navigated it. And there is something else. There are two moments, I think, in your life where you have more freedom. One moment is when you're young. You haven't got a mortgage. You haven't got kids. You can take the risk. Your cost opportunity is limited. But there is another moment, which is when they go to university, when the mortgage is paid.
Interesting, yeah. Right?
And suddenly you have freedom, you got time. So actually, I think it's an ideal moment. I wish, you know, all the institutional investors out there would see it like me. Mm-hmm. But it's quite empowering where you get to a point where you got the experience, you got the network, you don't have anymore the responsibility. In my case, I was the breadwinner. I was a single mom for most of the time I've been a mother. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the freedom mm-hmm. to do something entrepreneurial. But you get to a point in your career where is the time. And they go to university. I still have one at home, actually. but yes, that's a great moment, I think, to start a company. So I don't know if there are people there that are thinking about it. I would strongly encourage them to to be brave or to be realistic.
Okay, so before we wrap up, we do have a quick fire round of questions that we like to ask guests before we wrap up. So one of them being, you know, if you had 15 seconds to look back, Julia, what advice would you give to yourself back in 2010?
It's absolutely about taking care of yourself. You know, back in 2010, I did not have a spiritual practice, really. I definitely didn't have a physical practice. I wasn't meditating. I wasn't eating well. I wasn't really exercising. I was sleeping very poorly. And that caused so much stress and strain. And I really ran the risk of burning out.
Fantastic.
Thank you. And happy holidays.
Yes, happy holidays.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at The Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.